great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, talking legal issues on the show today. To begin the show with a couple of attorneys for you as we talk about power of attorney and wills and insurance, estate planning. And our two guests, one of them, Emily Sellner, not back with us. This is your first time, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Emily's an associate attorney at Axley Law Firm. She focuses on estate planning, and thanks for coming by today.
Happy to be here.
With us as well, back with us, Mike Riley. Michael Riley, retired Madison attorney. His practice focused on getting fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to other people's negligence. Also represented clients in insurance coverage issues, mediation, and arbitration. He's an up-counsel attorney at Axley Law Firm. And Mike, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry.
And as a reminder to you, as you listen in, our discussion today, it's intended as general information. You should not rely on it or construe it as legal advice. But I hope you'll join in with your questions, maybe about writing a will or planning your estate. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Emily, to start with you, I'm a power of attorney. I've been a power of attorney for three different folks. But talk about there are different kinds of power of attorney, as I have discovered.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Wisconsin, we have two different types of power of attorney. One power of attorney deals with healthcare decisions, and the other power of attorney is called a general durable power of attorney, and I commonly refer to that as a financial power of attorney. Wisconsin is one of those states where you actually don't have a de facto power of attorney, so you actually have to fill out the form and name someone in both a healthcare power of attorney and general durable in order to have someone act for you on your behalf.
Yeah, and typically, how does someone select a power of attorney?
I like to go over the job descriptions. You know,
sure.
Someone who you're going to name as your healthcare power of attorney has to be someone that can handle talking with doctors, talking to nurses, making sure they advocate for your healthcare decisions. And I also say it's someone who can handle a tough decision when there's no good options. Usually a healthcare power of attorney is called in to make a decision when there is a problem. So someone that can be pragmatic and also advocate for what you would want, not necessarily what someone else would want.
Yeah.
For that general durable power of attorney, someone that's extremely organized, someone that can handle getting those documents to your accountant, looking at your bank statements and making sure all of your expenses are being paid month to month, and ensuring that all of your money is coming in that needs to. So really kind of two different skill sets as we look at those two different roles.
Yeah, and the durable would also write the checks on behalf of the friend or whoever.
Absolutely. They're your bookkeeper.
So once you're appointed as power of attorney, when does that become effective and their choices are relied on?
Yeah. So for healthcare power of attorney, that does not become active until two high-level medical professionals have determined you can no longer make your own decisions. So you still have the autonomy over your body until two medical professionals determine that you can no longer make those decisions. For general durable power of attorney, there's actually two different options. There are some that can be active right away, so the moment you sign it. So that person can act for you even if you have full capacity to make your own decisions. Another type is called a springing power. So that means it doesn't spring into action until the language in the document comes to fruition. And a lot of people have that contingent on healthcare power of attorney being activated.
Is there ever a time when somebody says, well, I don't want this person as power of attorney anymore? Or, I mean, what happens under a circumstance like that?
Yeah, so that's why it's always important to always review your power of attorney documents. I tell clients to review their power of attorney documents every 5 years, just to make sure that's still the same person that you think can make those decisions. Sometimes people move away, change jobs, and they're no longer that person that you think has the time devoted to it. By having someone removed, just execute a new one and name someone else to make sure they can serve in that role.
You know, one thing I think that might be worth talking about is these things can cause real tensions within a family, both
yeah.
in terms of who you select for power of attorney, who you select for personal rep, you know, for your estate. Not my field, it's Emily's, but I've certainly seen some of that myself, and I'm sure Emily's seen a good bit more of it.
And you mentioned estate and estate planning, and I think Susie in Janesville has a question relating to estate planning, so maybe a good time to go to there, to her. Susie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm over 60. My fiance is over 60. He owns his house. I own my house. We'd like to buy a house together. However, if we live in it for 20 years and the first person dies, how does his or her children get their inheritance? Any suggestions on how this would happen so that they get their fair share?
You know, we were going to talk about wills, and wills come to mind when, and something like this, Emily.
Yeah, absolutely. Susie, my recommendation is for you to get an attorney to help work through this. People don't appreciate how marital property rules impact on the situation on a second marriage and children from prior marriages. Usually in situations like that, we're honestly looking at the entire estate plan holistically to determine which assets need to go to spouse and which assets we need to carve out for children. The problem you highlighted is something that we deal with every day with individuals looking on remarriage and how that impacts their children from that prior marriage.
Yeah. So it's a will that you, is that handled through a will then? Or is
A will or trust, depending on what kind of other objectives we have, but absolutely getting something in writing. Some people rely on the state statutes to distribute their assets. You are one person where I would recommend doing a will or a trust to outline exactly what needs to happen because it's going to be a little bit different than the norm.
Yeah. Susie, there you go. So sit down with an attorney and... talk about wills or what's the other?
Trusts.
Trusts. Okay. Thank you very much for calling. Mike, to
Emily,
add there.
Emily made the point early on that so many of these situations, this one seems fairly straightforward to somebody who doesn't know the territory anyway. But, you know, it's so important in most situations. Things get complex really quickly. And while, you know, Emily's advice is great advice, it's not intended to be detailed, and it really can't be until you have all the facts. And that's why you get an attorney, you know, who knows the territory, who's good at his job. There are a lot of different ways to do that. Hopefully you get recommendations from friends or another attorney. But, you know, you find the right person with the right skill set, and they should be able to get you a very complete answer to those questions.
What information typically should we include in a will?
So when I think about a will, you know, when I have clients come into my office, the first thing I ask for is an estate planning questionnaire where they list out all of their assets and I get a general idea of their family members or general objectives. So with their will or a trust, whatever is going to be dispersing your assets, a lot of times we evaluate when someone comes into the office, okay, who do you want to receive the bulk of your estate or certain assets? Tell me what your goals are. Is it to take care of your minor children? Is it to take care of older children, siblings, relatives, charities? What are those goals? And then we also evaluate the different assets within your estate. Not every asset is treated equally for tax purposes, also for inheritance purposes. So evaluating those to say, okay, if we transfer these assets to your children, they have the best tax benefits, as opposed to passing these off to charities where they can receive the best tax benefits. So kind of evaluating all of those situations to make sure the people or individual organizations you want to receive your estate get that money in the most efficient way.
You know, one point, again, I'd make, Larry, is that it's your money, and you have every right to do what you want with it with the proper guidance. You have the right to do anything you want, but the proper guidance is crucial. But again, I think when you look at this, there's often a tendency to have some members of the family who are more favored than others. That's just human nature. But I think that people need to think, and I think good lawyers will discuss that with them, what's going to happen with the family dynamic? Because you put the money out there, but the kids are going to be living with the consequences of that decision for a long time. And again, doesn't mean that you have to just give everybody the same treatment in the will, but I think you do have to think carefully about not just the financial implications, but the interpersonal implications of those decisions.
Does a will need to be notarized?
there in the statutes outlines what equates a will. So there is a very specific outline of what needs to happen. You do need two witnesses. It does not need to be notarized, but there are a couple of different things that are required to make a will valid. One of the biggest things people don't appreciate is having the original will, so the actual wet signature. A lot of people have a copy, they give their family members copies, and then we can't find the original will. Having the original will is essential to remove some of the red tape that might happen that if we have to go to the court with a copy. So for anyone who's done their will and has it, put it in a really safe spot, make sure it's safe, and make sure everyone knows where it is in the event it's needed.
Emily, is there... I know this is, again, a very general question, and you have to know specifics, but it seems to me that trusts have gotten to be much more popular in the last 20 years, or at least I hear a lot more about them. What, you know, is there a general idea of when a trust works better or when a will works better?
Both wills and trusts can accomplish the same goals, which is taking your assets and giving them to those individuals or organizations you want to include. It's the process on how we get there. So wills take us through the probate process, so it's monitored by the court. Trusts are a way for us to avoid that court process and make it a completely private administration. Some families appreciate the private aspect. They don't want things going through court. They don't want the delays that sometimes accompany a probate. Or there might be other tax reasons where a trust would make sense. There's so many different types of trusts. So some trusts would help with taxes, some wouldn't. So understanding what type of trust you're getting and also what the objectives are. I'll say most people think they need a trust and they don't. And most people who don't think they need a trust do. So...
So where would a trust be in terms of what kind of a trust would help perhaps with a tax situation?
Yeah, so sometimes when we're planning on trying to take property that could have some type of estate tax liabilities or income tax that we don't want ourselves, we want to push off to somebody else in order to save on our lifetime exemption, we may be putting that into different types of irrevocable trusts in order to get that out of our estate. So there could be tax reasons that way, also income tax implications. And I do know that some people also look for Medicaid asset protection trusts in order to protect those assets from Medicaid as well. Mm.
You know, recently, I'm sure you saw it too, the Fox News family, the Murdochs, mm-hmm. had this long-running battle because there must have been an irrevocable trust. So you can't just say I changed my mind because Dad did change his mind. Mm-hmm. And then there were three or four kids, and one of them fell out of favor, and he'd been the heir apparent. And so Dad got mad and wanted to give it to somebody else. And, I mean, this was billions, of course, involved because a huge empire. But I know that went on for quite some time, I think recently settled. So what, I mean, why would you have an irrevocable trust? Because essentially once you do that, it just... You can't change your mind. And they couldn't. They didn't let them overturn the trust, even though Dad, who had created the trust, wanted to.
Mm-hmm. The number one reason is taxes. There are other reasons, but I would say most often it's to get things out of our estate. And to do that, you need to give up a lot of that control. And that's when, you know, I can't change it anymore. That's giving up that level of control over the asset.
David in Madison has a question, and we'll get to that in just a minute. A quick reminder, our guests today, attorneys Emily Sellner, associate attorney at Axley Law Firm, Michael Riley, and of counsel attorney at Axley Law Firm. Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk with attorneys Emily Sellner and Michael Riley about all kinds of things. We're looking at wills, power of attorney, estate planning, insurance kinds of issues, accident sort of issues coming up as well as we move along here. And you can join in again. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. David and Madison, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question about dementia and how it relates to estate planning. And I'm wondering if your guests have run across this. We have a situation where a family member made some rather important financial changes and then was not able to get the diagnosis for a couple of months. So now, of course, we're in a strange situation, and I'm wondering what your guests maybe have dealt with this situation in the past.
Okay.
I have had some situations, and Dave, just to start, very unfortunate. Sorry that you're going through this. So unfortunately, what you've kind of highlighted is that period of time where someone is maybe slowly losing capacity, but hasn't met that legal definition of no longer has capacity to make those decisions. So it's really important. And, you know, there's not much you can maneuver depending on what kind of changes they made to their estate plan, but or where they're at in their dementia journey. So really, on the front end, when someone realizes that they may have these problems, and I realize this is for other listeners, or may have this in the future, it's going to be really important to find an attorney and find family members that you really trust to help you look at the situation and decide if, when you want to make changes later, if that matches with your plans from before. So really, it's kind of keeping that cohesive plan. Depending on the estate planning documents that they signed or changes that were made, there could be things that you could do to invalidate those changes if they don't match with what the overall plan was. But it's really going to hinge on what level of capacity they had at the time that they made those decisions. I'm going to tell you those types of cases are extremely difficult because it's hard for us to have enough facts to evaluate the situation. So it's going to be one of those where maybe you all realize that's not what that individual wanted 10 years ago, but we may be stuck with it based on where things are at now.
Sit down with an attorney on it. Yeah. Okay. David, good luck, and thank you for calling. Mary in Coloma will go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I am calling with a question with regarding corporations and estate planning. You've talked about trust, you've talked about wills, but what about using corporations as part of your estate plan? A good or a bad idea?
And by using corporations, what do you mean there, Mary?
Well, let's say your primary residence. Instead of holding it in your own name, you create an LLC to hold that property. Or maybe you've got a business that you're a sole proprietor of, and you want to move it into a corporation so that it's not under your name alone.
Mm-hmm. I would say a lot of individuals now use LLCs as a way to have the protections that a business organization can have, but also provide an easy avenue for us to transfer assets for individuals who are going to be part of the business. So I like to use this as an example. I grew up on a small dairy farm outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin. So I see dairy farms all the time in my client base, and a lot of them set up limited liability companies to hold some of their assets, the cows, for example, because one kid is going to be staying in the farm after parents pass and other kids are not. So we use the LLC to kind of separate our business assets from our other personal assets. And then through that LLC, we can eventually have that child become part of the business and provide that framework as to how they're going to operate the business. However, there does need to be a business purpose for the LLC. So if it's holding rental property, vacant property, and actual operations of a business. You know, just setting up an LLC as a way to transfer assets to the next generation isn't always going to give you those LLC protections that we normally find. So there does have to be kind of that business aspect to it in order for it to be used as a vehicle to transfer assets.
Okay.
As Emily points out, one of the primary reasons for an LLC is to protect your assets so that if there's a situation where something happens within the LLC, if there's a liability situation, it could be fairly dramatic. And we had a case not that many years ago where people who had very, very substantial assets, both in terms of some other property, but also a trucking firm, and they hadn't created the proper corporate setup to separate all those things. And there was a tragic accident involving the trucking firm, and it exposed all of their assets, which were multi-million dollar assets beyond the firm. And that's why, again, if you're going to do any of these things, as Emily points out, talk to a lawyer, make sure you're getting protections. You know, we see, always see this stuff on TV about will kits, for example, and there's comparable things about create your own corporation. Well, you know, these things are really important financial decisions, and just relying on a kit without a lawyer there to really talk to you, not just to tell you how to fill in the blanks, which may be fairly self-evident, but to tell you what you should be concerned about and what you should do, not just, you know, why you should be worried about certain things and how to deal with those things, not just, you know, whether you can say who you want to leave, you know, your old tea set to.
Mary, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Bob emailed us, can you discuss transfer on death versus trusts?
Mm-hmm. Transfer on death is a mechanism, depending on the type of asset, the form looks a little different. So immediately upon someone's death, it transfers to whatever you want it to transfer to. So sometimes that's transferring it into a trust. Sometimes that's transferring it to an individual. The typical situation I see is deeds. You can actually record a transfer on death designation on your home for it to immediately transfer to whatever you would like it to. You can also do that for any company interest. So hitting back on the last question, LLC interest or corporation interest, depending on the type of entity.
And could you transfer on death? Let's say your asset basically is your house. That's worth a fair amount of money, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got two or three kids. Can you do a transfer on death to all two or three of them? And then they own the home instantly?
Yeah, absolutely. I see some people do that. And I always caution families. For some families, that works out perfect. All of your kids get along. Everyone can co-own property with one another. Make sure that the real estate taxes are paid. Make sure that the pipes don't freeze. You have to think about your kids and how they would interact with each other if mom and dad are not there shaking their finger saying everybody needs to get along. Some people are not meant to co-own property. And that's why we have a trust in order some or will to kind of outline who's in charge, how does this get done, so the money can be distributed equally, but maybe not the asset. So some families, we do TODs directly to their three children. Other families, I caution, and we have a trust.
Okay. Robert emailed us, what's the difference, and we did talk about this a little bit, but what's the difference between revocable and irrevocable trust, specifically with parents and protecting from Medicaid?
Mm-hmm.
If the house is put in an irrevocable trust and the parents still live in the house, how does that work? If the kids are the trustees, do the parents in the house have to lease the house back from the kids to pay them rent?
It is a very complex area. So people need to understand that the evaluations done for public assistance when you go into a nursing home really rely on a different set of tests than what we do under the Internal Revenue Code for tax purposes. So anytime that you're trying to do what this sounds like to me is a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, mm-hmm. there's a significant level of control you need to give up in order to have that asset protected. Those types of trusts are really, I recommend people find a specialist to talk to your family, to talk to you, so you really understand the trade-offs there. Not every attorney should be doing these areas because they're very fact-intensive and they're very, the regulations are really in-depth.
Mel in Madison emailed us. Mel is currently updating the will and has a question about planned giving. If Mel intends to leave the bulk of the estate to a nonprofit organization, is there any advantage in notifying them through their planned giving program?
Yes. So some organizations very much like to hear about this type of plan giving on the front end because they want to thank you. You know, what the hard thing for a lot of these organizations is they receive money when someone's already passed and they're thanking family members, which is great, but they really want to thank you. So a lot of times people want to know about these gifts so you can be part of some of the things they do each year for all of those individuals who have named that organization. I think another thing that people don't think about is not every organization is equipped to handle some of the assets you may be transferring. A house, a painting collection, things that you have to do a little bit of work in order to actually get the cash. Being upfront with some of these organizations may help you plan better so it can be easier for them to take the asset and do the good work that you intend for those, that money to go for.
Interesting. I know a situation where a person died and left half. He had one child, left half, and his only asset was the house. So he left half the house to his church and half the house to his sister, or to his daughter. And it worked out, apparently, okay, but... That's a situation that would be a little different, I would guess.
Absolutely.
What would happen? I mean, if the daughter says, I'd like to live there, but you know, you have to pay rent to the church, or what would you do in that situation?
Yes, a lot of times my goal is for everybody to leave with their items so they can get out of each other's hair. So sometimes it's a, hey, I'll buy your half out for this amount in order for you to continue to have the house and the charity to receive their money. But that doesn't always happen. But the goal is so everybody can leave with their assets.
I think in this case, the house was sold and then just the profits or whatever, whatever
right.
was left was split down the middle with the church and the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one way. It worked out okay. And that's, I think the daughter already had her own house.
Anyway. As lawyers, I mean, obviously planning's critical because otherwise as lawyers, you know, we deal with the situations where it doesn't work out, and now you're trying to sort out the mess that's been left. And that's why advanced planning is so important.
The Kevin in Eau Claire emailed us. Kevin's curious how to handle a situation where there isn't anyone available to be a personal representative. Executor, for example. Kevin's parents counted on him in their will, but Kevin doesn't have children or close relatives in the area. So how do you handle a situation like this where you really don't have somebody?
Yeah, so I would say I've noticed its popularity over the past couple of years. There's something called a corporate fiduciary. So sometimes banks, accounting firms, law firms, other places that have that fiduciary liability insurance and that have that capability can actually step in and serve as the personal representative or trustee. So you can actually hire a company essentially to come in and do that work. Sometimes families use that when they have tons of family members and no one's capable. And sometimes people use it when they don't have anybody else, but they want to make sure that money gets where it needs to. So there are various businesses in town who will do that service. And they also provide a fee schedule up front. So everybody knows, hey, I'm going to be asking Emily, for example, to do this work. And this is how much she would charge based on the size of the estate.
And I could guess another situation is where you had a bunch of family members and they all wanted to do it.
Everyone thinks they want the job, right?
Yeah, and if you picked one, the rest of them would be mad and there'd be, yeah.
Yeah, I think I talked to a lot of families that say, well, my oldest child should do the job. And then I actually give the job description and they say, oh, wait a minute. That's not any of our children. So that's where a lot of these companies come into play.
Emily Sellner and Michael Riley from the Axley Law Firm, our guests today. We've been talking estates, power of attorney, wills. We haven't gotten much into insurance yet, but we'll certainly get into that as well as we move along today. And if you have a question or comment, maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us the email address talk@wpr.org. What if you don't have an estate plan?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people take for granted the statutes and rely on those to disperse assets in your estate. Some people, it works out perfectly. It matches exactly what your wishes are. For a lot of people, it doesn't work. So our statutes outline, you know, if I pass away and have a surviving spouse and all of the children we have are of the marriage, everything goes to surviving spouse. Or if I do have children and no spouse, everything goes to my children. And I always like to describe to clients, we basically go down the family tree and right back up. So it goes amongst all of your family members, depending on who survives who and in what order. If you don't have power of attorney documents, that's a bit more problematic. You'll actually have to go through a guardianship proceeding where individuals who have standing can go to the court and say, this person doesn't have anyone to make healthcare decisions for them or financial, and they need assistance. The judge evaluates the situation and then picks somebody and gives them specific powers on what to do.
And that could be a problem if, I mean, I'm thinking from personal experience, if somebody suddenly goes down, and there needs to be things taken care of right away, if that hasn't been done in advance, but you need action right now.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a case a few years ago here in Dane County. We had an emergency guardianship, so it was a situation that needed immediate judge attention, and we were not able to get a hearing for a week and a half. So the court's definition of emergency, a little bit different than a family's in these situations. That's why power of attorney documents are so essential. You're appointing someone to jump in for you so we can cut through a lot of the other steps and make sure you get the care you need.
You know, again, just so I know we sound like a broken record, but doing things in advance is so critical, because the last thing you want on any of this stuff is litigation. We talked a little bit about that, the trust situation with Murdoch's. I mean, they spent $100 million in legal fees, which to them may not be a lot, but to most folks, and obviously ordinary people don't spend that kind of money, but you can still spend a lot of money in litigation if families get into disputes. And the more clarity you have in your planning documents, the less likely that is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Another listener called, couldn't stay with us, but wondering if a power of attorney can charge you money to take care of your estate, or is there some sort of normal fee type situation?
Yeah, that person can be paid. So I think a lot of people, and this is one thing, if you're serving as the power of attorney and wondering if you can get paid for your services, I would highly recommend you getting your own attorney to represent you in your role as power of attorney. Different from the person you're taking care of has an estate planning attorney likely who put these documents together. So get your own attorney in order to come up with what is an appropriate fee for the work being done. Sometimes that can be done on the front end. Okay, so sometimes I do have individuals who already lay out in their power of attorney, I want this person to be paid, I want them to be paid this rate, and other people, we have to come up with a situation, because it can be a lot of work. I mean, my hope for everybody is no one needs a power of attorney, because you pass away in your sleep and you don't need anybody to kind of handle all this. But that's unfortunately not everybody's story.
No, it is not. Steve in Lake Tomahawk area, we'll go to you next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, this is Stephen Lake Tomahawk area. Is that who you're talking to?
That's right. What's on your mind?
Okay. Just three quick ones. My wife and I have not done a will. We're getting later in life. And so I have three quick ones. One, we're the beneficiary of each other on almost all our assets and such. So if one of us only died, not looking at down the line to our kids, how important is a will in that case? Does the spouse pretty much just take over since she's already listed?
Yeah.
Second thing is, if I can quick throw in just a quick word on just initiating a will. We haven't done it yet. We do a little homework. And what kind of paperwork should we have if we contact an attorney? Mm-hmm. And I guess the third thing, if I could do it quick, is how legitimate is doing your own will? You know, you see them online and such.
Okay. Three different things there. So first is the spouse situation. Yeah. If it's just the two, but it sounded like also there might have been kids down the road there.
Mm-hmm. The big thing is going to be to make sure that your spouse is on everything, either as a joint owner or a beneficiary. So we can take advantage of the marital property rules where things go to spouse, depending on how it's titled. It really depends if the children are of the marriage. If children are of the marriage, then under intestacy laws, everything goes to spouse anyway. So we might have to go through probate. But most of the time in Wisconsin, we usually are doing a probate on second spouse's death. So usually by operation of law, things automatically go to that surviving spouse. When you're thinking about initiating a will, the biggest thing for you, and you may say, well, wait a minute, everything goes to spouse and then our three kids gets divided. Sometimes it's naming someone to be in charge. You're the person who's going to be going to court. You're the one who's going to sell the things because you're the family member who can handle it. So putting together that kind of chain of command. When you're looking to get a will done, my recommendation is for you to collect everyone's full legal names and addresses, spouse, children, grandchildren. Think about what your goals are and getting a list of your assets. I usually ask for someone to say, okay, tell me what the asset is and the approximate value, just so I can understand where your net worth is and should we be using direct beneficiaries, should we be using a trust, a will. So if you can collect all of that and come into your attorney's office with, these are my goals and these are my assets, it should make the process a bit more efficient.
And these are my beneficiaries and here's their address.
Yeah, absolutely. Now going online, Wisconsin is a marital property state. I think I've said that a few times. Not every state is a marital property state. So sometimes I do think a lot of these programs that we look into, they're just meant to fit the nationwide example and they have a Wisconsin template, but we have different laws here. You need to understand them. So not all the every program is created equal. Talking to an attorney, I can promise you, depending on the right one, like you're going to make sure that your estate plan fits with Wisconsin law, make sure that your beneficiaries are taken care of, and they also have a resource for when you pass who to go to. I get calls all the time from kids saying, my parents didn't have an estate planner. Now they've passed. We don't know what to do. So sometimes it's just getting that local connection to make sure that your kids are taken care of and have someone to help them guide to the next step.
You know, I grew up in an era where there were an awful lot of general practitioners, in effect, and lawyers who did soup to nuts. And there still are, particularly in smaller towns, I think there are still a fair number of those out there. And they may well be familiar with a lot of issues dealing with wills and powers of attorney and everything, but it's not a sure thing. And I think that when you're selecting a lawyer to talk to, the profession has become increasingly specialized. And it really makes sense to talk to a lawyer whose practice is focused in these areas. Again, not suggesting that somebody couldn't do it, but I think the probability that you're going to get the best possible advice increases dramatically when you go to somebody who really focuses on that area of the law. And, you know, there are a lot of ways to look for people. As I said, you can get referrals from friends or other lawyers who maybe are generalists or who do, as I did, personal injury, but who can get you to the right kind of lawyer. Martindale Hubbell is sort of the national rating organization, and you really want somebody who is at least a BV. AV is, you know, preeminent. That's really what I think is an important consideration, not the only one. Some of it's length of practice and things like that, but that's important. Milwaukee Magazine does an annual super lawyers thing where they evaluate lawyers, and that's another source you might want to look at. But the best thing to me is to get a referral from another lawyer if you can, or from friends who've used a particular lawyer. And then it's always a good idea, go and meet with the lawyer and interview him. These are really important decisions. If you're not completely comfortable with the lawyer, talk to someone else. You know, I think that's very important.
And down the line, and for wills, if I'm not mistaken, there is some information on the State Bar Association of Wisconsin relating to wills, Emily?
Yeah, there's a lot of online resources Wisconsin has. I think the biggest thing I see is everyone says, we're simple. And it's interpreting that information. So everyone says, well, it's a standard plan, but I have this, but I have that. And that's the part that it's just really hard to read a couple articles to understand what you should be doing.
Steve, thanks again. Appreciate it. Yuri in Janesville, we'll get to you in just a minute. A quick reminder, we're talking with Emily Sellner and Michael Riley of the Axley Law Firm. I'm Larry Mueller. Coming up at 12:30 today, we'll hear how one Dane County organization is working to create a stronger food system. But right now, we're taking your legal questions with our two guests, Emily Sellner and Michael Riley of the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have them with us. And we've got lots of callers online, so let's go to Yuri in Janesville next. Hi, Yuri.
Good morning. My question has to do with death with dignity. My father recently passed due to Parkinson's in the last 5-6 months were nothing short of horrific. And it's my understanding is wills are, you know, after the fact, when you're, you know, after you've passed. I have a son who's a financial planner. He's the executor for financial. Daughter is a charge nurse at Northwestern. She's an executor for the financial, not for the medical, I'm trying to say. And so these are all things after I pass. But how do I instruct them to do whatever when it's clear that I'm on the way out to assist that? Some of the states, not Wisconsin, have death with dignity. I'm a little bit lost as to what to do about that.
So one thing I want to correct you on, that power of attorney of health care, you mentioned that. That is something that's active while you're living, and the power actually ceases upon your death. So that's the form that I would add those provisions in. So in the state form, there's actually a chance for you to put special directives. That's where I would put those. I even have some individuals go so far as to attach an addendum explaining kind of generally what they're looking for as it relates to some of those death with dignity provisions. The other thing is in the state form, there's something called a Wisconsin Living Will provision. So that is, yes, I want feeding tubes if I'm terminal. No, I do not. Those kinds of black and white issues. But to fill in those other pieces, I would add special directives in that healthcare power of attorney. Your doctors receive it. Your healthcare power of attorney receives it. And they're going to want to do the best they can to uphold what you've put in there.
DNRs, do not resuscitate. Orders.
Hospitals have those as well. And so there's extra forms that you can fill out for some of the black and white issues. But if you're looking for, you know, I have certain people come in and say, you know, I want feeding tubes, but not after this point. Or they're looking for something a little bit more gray. Mm-hmm. That's when I would put in that balancing test and make sure the person you have appointed has a general approach to how you see it. You know, I had one individual who said, I'm going to name my brother. He went and talked to his brother, and his brother said, I can't do your wishes because I just mentally could not do that, and I view what you're looking for as something that doesn't match with what I value. So talking to that person ahead of time, you know, especially with Parkinson's, some of these other diseases that can get very difficult, someone having that same approach as you.
My wife and I actually just did this, and you can often do it through your healthcare provider, you know, at least, again, if you don't have special circumstances or don't need more detail. And it was instructive to sit down with them because they do raise certain questions. The form itself says, you know, what do you want to do? But then they talk to you about what that implies and, you know, what the concerns might be. And I think it's something that if you don't have that, you should. And again, you can do it, at least we could, we're with UW Health, and we could do it through them. Didn't cost us anything to do it. And the person who did it with us was a social worker and actually, I thought, did a very good job of explaining all the levels of concern and the certain what people have told her about what they were worried about or weren't concerned about. Seemed fairly simple for us, but it certainly isn't for everyone. And again, Emily's right on the money. You've got to make sure you've got the right person because with these things, you know, religious convictions could really play a role for somebody mm-hmm. who's asked to do this and doesn't feel comfortable doing something that would essentially not assist someone to continue living, you know, beyond a certain point. So I think this is a huge societal issue for my generation because mm-hmm. we're all getting there all too quickly. And people really need to think carefully about this. And I think most people I know certainly don't want their life prolonged when there's no quality of life left.
Yeah. Yuri, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Larry in Rice Lake, what's on your mind?
So recently I became power of attorney for finances and property for my brother, and he's now in assisted living, and this all came on pretty quick. But his account at his financial place, so I could pay his bills and take care of things for him. What we did is we just put both of our names on one account, savings and checking, and if something would happen to him, I would have access to the money for final expenses and for dispersing through the will. But and so right now we're looking at getting money from his IRA to pay for his assisted living. Not a huge amount of money will come from the IRA, but secondary to that, we're selling his house to help pay for assisted living, and that's a little bit bigger sum of money that will last several years, hopefully. So I was wondering the best way to have those funds in place with or without my name on the accounts. And the only reason I would be concerned that my names would be on them is I'm not sure what would happen for taxation on interest in those accounts at the end of the year and how it would affect me.
Yeah.
Any advice there could be, you could help, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it depends on how accounts are titled. I think you hit on a tax issue that is important, but also it's the disbursement of those assets when your brother passes. So typically with a bank account, we will see people as joint title holders. Well, that means when your brother passes, you become the sole owner of that asset. So that asset is not actually subject to probate. People don't realize that. It's yours. So whatever your brother has in his will, if it's supposed to go to six different people, really that's you saying, I'm going to give up my money because once he passes, it's yours, to those six people. So a lot of people don't appreciate that that joint title holder succeeds to that interest. And then it's a gift from you, not the estate. So for some families, if the beneficiary, the primary beneficiary is also the POA, we do the joint title holder because it doesn't need to go through probate. For other people, having that joint title holder could actually frustrate the overall estate plan when your brother passes.
Lots to think about there, for sure, Larry. So the so Larry could, let's say Larry's or anybody's, you have that situation and the person, so there, let's say there's $200,000 in that house sale that's clear and the person dies next month.
Then you are
suddenly you have the $200,000 is what you're saying.
Absolutely. And then figuring out what to do to not cause hard feelings can be difficult.
Well, and then there's a tax situation, because if you're trying to then give $100,000 to your sister, that's a gift tax then.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an extra form. So I usually recommend for individuals that are worried about being able to pay expenses post-death. So we're talking about the funeral expenses. I think that's what everyone is kind of top of mind. Sometimes I have individuals just have a small account that has just enough in it to get them where they need to. Other families, I say, you know what, the attorney needs to be the first call and we're going to get a probate going as soon as possible and work with the funeral home to make sure that they understand they're going to get paid. We just have to get through some of that paperwork first.
Emily, when you do, if you just inherit money, however, through a will or intestate or however you do, is that subject to a tax?
Not the inheritance of the money, but if that asset has some income tax implications, the income, you could still be subject to income tax from it when you go ahead and sell it or transfer
it. But if your parents die and they leave you $100,000, that's not going to be subject to tax, assuming it's just a cash transaction.
Correct.
We are talking with Emily Sellner and Michael Riley from the Axley Law Firm, and they'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News, talking legal issues on the show today. Our guests, Emily Sellner and Michael Riley. Emily, an associate attorney at Axley Law Firm of Madison. Michael's an of counsel attorney at the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have both of them with us today. We've been talking a lot about probate, wills, estates, planning, and more with them. And I hope you'll join in with your own. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Our phone in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Kathy in Harshaw next. Kathy, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, and thank you for having this program. I'm 72 years old, a widow. I have two daughters. I did do power of attorney. One daughter, the youngest daughter, has my medical, and my oldest daughter has my financial for power of attorney. And then I also drew up a will. I did add both daughters to the deed of our property. And on my bank account, I designated both daughters as beneficiaries to split. Is there anything else I need to do? My oldest daughter's concerned. She's recently moved home with me. I had some health concerns, and she's staying with me at this time. But if I should pass away, that she will be locked out of the house until the property is probated. But I said, no, you own this property jointly with your sister and myself. So is that true, or do I need to do something more?
And have you added them to the current warranty deed, or did something called a transfer on death designation?
Oh, I added them to the current deed.
Okay. Then they are joint owners with you. So you are correct in that if something were to happen to you, depending on making sure all of you are joint tenancy holders, your interest would then go to your two daughters. So the daughter who lives with you now would not be kicked out of the home. However, I would probably talk to both of your daughters about what the plan would be. If we have one daughter living in the house and one not, you know, is there rent that needs to be paid? How are expenses being handled? Because I'm sure there's certain expenses that will be incurred by the home because your one daughter lives there and is using the home as opposed to it sitting vacant. Insurance, things like that. So really, it's great that she can stay in the home, but making sure you can avoid any little tiffs that could happen between your two kids when dealing with those little expenses that seem little but add up.
Yeah. All right.
Now, with the insurance, I think you do want to make sure that they're both on the insurance policy as well, because otherwise, if something happens to the home, I'm sure that ultimately they would be the beneficiaries, but that might involve probate or might involve at least some other legal proceeding to accomplish what you intend, which is if there were a loss to the home, that they would be the beneficiaries and the insurance would pay them or pay the damages to them.
Kathy, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Catherine in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My husband has passed away, and I need to change the will to more fit my wishes rather than what we had set up. Now, I have three children, two boys who are they don't need any of the money, and they said give everything to my daughter, who is on Medicare and Medicaid. What should I be using? What kind of trust should I be using for that particular situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have an attorney?
Not yet, but I am working on it. Okay. I have the old will does state that. One of my sons has the power of this or that or whatever, but his address is wrong, so everything has to be changed.
Yeah. So anytime that, and this is more than just Medicaid, but it's really anyone who's receiving public benefits, I always caution clients, we really shouldn't be giving them directly the money because that could actually impact whether they're eligible for benefits. So working with an attorney and you absolutely need to find one that can help you set up a trust for your daughter so the money can go into that trust and is managed and is not included in the calculations for her public benefits. So you can set that up through your will. You can set it up through a separate trust, but any money that you want to leave her needs to be handled differently, and it's extremely restrictive. So it's not just a general trust. It is a special one.
Emily, the question that raised in my mind is you have this situation where they have a joint will, but then one of the partners dies. What is that will still operative then, or do you need to do a new will? I mean, obviously she needs to do something because she wants to change the provisions. Mm-hmm. But what would does that will still remain effective once one of the partners dies?
Yeah, I would say as a profession, we're moving a lot more towards what I call mirror wills. So each will mirrors each other and everyone has their own separate one while it's part of one joint plan. So if one spouse dies, that's their will and my will is still in effect, but I can always change that depending on what the needs are at the time.
In her situation, is the will still in effect, the will that she had jointly with her husband?
It depends if both of their names are on. My guess is that her will is both of them are mirror wills and they say the exact same terms.
Yeah. But if it wasn't and something happened to her today, then the original will, if it hasn't been changed yet, is the will.
Correct.
Yeah. So that's Catherine. I'm glad you called. Thank you so much for calling. And the whole business about Medicaid, because there's you can only have so much money in your account or anywhere and be eligible.
Yeah, there's a significant amount of programs where income is used as a calculation to determine if you're eligible. So that's why, you know, anytime that someone's receiving benefits, that's an important question to ask the parent if you want to leave money to a grandchild that has special needs or anybody who's on public benefits to see if income is a component to their eligibility.
Yeah. Catherine, thank you for calling. Doug in Colfax, on to you now. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thanks much for this program. I've got a somewhat unique situation. I'm in my 60s, but had children later in life, and I own some rental property, and I'm wondering if a revocable trust might be appropriate, especially if I pass before they become adults. I just really don't want it to go to my ex.
Yeah, okay.
So what's really nice about a revocable trust is none of that goes through probate. So any asset that goes through probate is subject to the probate process, and there's probate fees. It's 0.02% of the entire estate. So sometimes setting up a revocable trust in the long term is actually cheaper from a legal perspective because we spend more of that upfront costs, but then we avoid some of the probate fees that come through. So if you're looking to keep these rental properties and specifically want them to be managed while your kids are minors and still get that income from it or whatever age you decide, setting up a revocable trust may be a great idea because you can put someone in a position to continue to manage the properties and hold the funds instead of having that outright distribution or having the court involved. So I would recommend having that revocable trust. And I will say, if you do have minor children, it's going to be essential that you have a will in order for you to name a guardian for those children. So you can't actually terminate parental rights through a will. But what you can do is say, look, if no one can take my kids because my spouse or my ex-spouse is also deceased and now there's no one to take care of my kids, that guardian nomination is in your will. So you should need both a will and a revocable trust.
So what's the benefit of using a revocable trust instead of an irrevocable trust in this kind of situation?
You can continue to change it. So I always tell people my goal is for your kids to turn out to be the adults that you expect them to be and can handle their own affairs. So, you know, maybe you start your trust being very restrictive. They can only get money for certain things. Someone else manages it for them. They can't get the money till a certain age. And then slowly work towards having that outright distribution. The revocable trust allows you to flex with your family plans and needs.
Doug, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Judy in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. So my situation is about a car title. My dad passed away, it'll be a year ago, this coming Saturday, and he had all of his, he had all of his affairs in order, with the exception of his car, which is titled in Florida, because we moved him from Florida to Wisconsin. He was able to get plates and everything, but he never titled his car in Wisconsin. And the state of Florida requires you to fill out a form. Every surviving child of the deceased has to sign this form for them to send you the title. And unfortunately, I do have two siblings, but they're not being cooperative with even responding back to me. So we've had my dad's car sitting in our driveway since last September. So my question is, do you have any advice on our options, and can we possibly even sell this asset in the state of Wisconsin, or you know, give it away, I mean, without a car title?
So glad we've got Emily here.
That's not an easy question. So I've had a couple individuals who've had vehicles titled in Florida. They have a very different process than Wisconsin as far as transferring the title. And anytime you're going to have this vehicle and need to transfer it to somebody, they're going to want the vehicle title. So you might be in a difficult spot if you're unable to fill out the Florida forms. I'm unsure if you're serving in some type of fiduciary capacity, so we have to worry about if you wanted to just scrap the car, if it is worth something and no one will sign, could one of your siblings have an action against you later? So it's definitely, I wish I had a straight answer for you, but it's probably going to involve you talking to someone who's licensed in Florida, because I have to believe this isn't the first time this has happened where siblings don't want to sign DMV forms on what you would need to do to get that car title to transfer.
Yeah, the Florida attorney. And how would you go about that? Look at the Florida Bar Association and
so if
get
you,
a name from there.
If you know any attorneys here in Wisconsin, we refer work to different attorneys that we work with in Florida all the time.
Oh,
so sometimes okay. It's talking to someone here and saying, hey, do you have someone you know in Florida? And somebody knows somebody. And hopefully you can get someone that would be able to help you. Otherwise, it's going to involve, you know, as Mike pointed out earlier, using national websites to see who has this expertise in this area in the particular city you're looking for.
The difficulty with these situations, you know, depending on the vehicle, but, you know, you could easily end up spending as much money as the vehicle is worth trying to get this done. I wonder if it'd be possible to bring some sort of action in Wisconsin, if a Wisconsin court would step in, especially if this wasn't included in the will, it sounds like, from what she said. She said he'd made dispositions of everything else except that. Or I wonder if what she means is he did make a disposition, but he hadn't, you know, because of the title problem, even though you own the car, you don't have the title.
Right. Yeah. And so it's, even if it was subject to Wisconsin probate, we eventually got to get the title. And so that involves kind of two different state jurisdictional laws on trying to get this vehicle, which I'm going to guess is not worth the legal headache that it's about to be.
Yeah,
could be.
But you need to get a hold of a Florida attorney from the sound of it, Judy. Kevin in Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would just quick question. I'm a co-owner of some property, and we're listed on a, I don't have the deed with right in front of me, but I believe the term is joint tenancy. And I guess my question is, what does that mean in terms of inheritance as one owner passes on?
Yeah.
Can you comment on that at all in Wisconsin? I believe we're called joint tenants.
Yeah, great question. So joint tenancy means the entire interest goes to the survivor. Okay? So joint tenancy goes to the survivor. Tenants in common means each of you own a one-half interest. So you can transfer your one-half interest to whoever you would like. It doesn't necessarily go to the joint holder. In Wisconsin, and this is kind of an extra ad, if you can also have something titled as marital property with rights of survivorship, and then that also goes to the spouse. So Marital property with rights of survivorship and joint tenancy go to the co-owner. Tenants in common goes however your will or trust or other documents say.
You know, one last thought for the prior caller. If the vehicle was part of probate, I wonder if the probate judge would order the other sibs to sign. I mean, that might be at least worth trying, because that would be a lot less expensive, I would think, than trying to do something in Florida. Anyway, yeah, just a thought.
Kevin, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerome in Baraboo will go to you next. Hi, Jerome.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm joining late, so maybe you addressed this, but I wondered if I've kind of heard both ways that a holographic will is and hold up in the state of Wisconsin, and then I heard it might not. So just wondering.
Okay.
That is a correct legal analysis. it really depends. And I don't know if you're in a position where the person's already deceased. So we have to try to get something submitted to the court. People don't appreciate when you do a will, whether it's with an attorney or you write it up yourself and hopefully follow the statutes on how it's supposed to be executed. You submit that to the court and you say, everyone, this is what I believe to be the last will. Now, sometimes we can go through an informal process where all the beneficiaries sign off and the register and probate looks at it and says, yes, okay, everyone's in agreement. This is the will we'll accept. Other times, the register and probate or beneficiaries say, wait a minute, I don't know if that's the original will. And then that actually goes through a formal probate procedure before a judge. And then everyone has to make their case as to why this is or is not the original will. So it's not presumed. It's always we have to apply to the court and say this is it. And the court goes through their process to make sure that it follows the formalities and is the final last will.
What's a holographic will?
So it's when you are writing it out yourself as opposed to, you know, using an attorney.
I was thinking that it was a video or something.
I watched Star Trek, so I assumed it was one of those, yeah.
Jerome, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Michael emailed us, what happens to a person's assets if they have no will and no living relatives?
So we do have an intestacy statute, which I mentioned earlier in the show, but didn't go into too much detail. It kind of goes through the process to find relatives. So they will make a very exhaustive search to find, you know, second cousins twice removed. I mean, it's an exhaustive search. If there really is absolutely no family members, then eventually that gets turned over to the state of Wisconsin. So that's, they do go through, you have attorneys who are appointed to represent unknown heirs and go find heirs. The goal is to find that family member who is not listed.
10th cousin twice removed.
Absolutely.
Okay. Kim emailed us, after you engage with an estate planner and have your documents prepared, how often should we expect the planner to stay engaged with you?
For me, I usually give clients an instruction letter on you review your estate plan and let me know when you have changes or you have things that you would like to be have done. Obviously, if there's changes in the law that I think would impact certain clients, I'm reaching out to them. But for the most part, I'm sitting in the background and waiting until you need me to do something. So I tell clients to review their estate plans at a minimum every 5 years. I usually give clients a binder with instructions on how to review their documents to make sure it matches with what they're looking for. And then if they want to make changes at that point, you can come into our office. Some clients prefer to review it with the attorney and they give me an update of their family and we talk about how things don't always work with the current plan and then make changes as needed.
Life insurance. If you have life insurance and you pass on and the life insurance is distributed, but it's held back some tax money. There's some tax money held back. Is there a way to reclaim that tax money?
So there is a process for payment of tax and receiving refunds, both at the state of Wisconsin level and at the IRS level. So there are different procedures. I would highly recommend anyone who's like looking to try to get tax money back, work with an accountant. Attorneys can do it. I do it with my probates when we're trying to get money back for particular assets. But accountants have really good connections and know who to reach out to when it comes to filing returns or having assets and you need to reclaim a refund.
What would you normally, would the insurance normally be taxable? I guess I'm not understanding exactly what the problem is.
There can be some times where the funds are sitting there and they didn't claim it for a while, so there's interest that accrues. So there could be tax implications from not the base amount, but other things, and then with the insurance.
But normally, if you have an insurance policy, person dies and the beneficiary gets the money, that doesn't trigger taxes on that money, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And Carol emailed us, how does one include a daughter-in-law as an heir should something happen to the son?
So that is exactly why you would need to do a will or a trust, because your daughter-in-law is not considered in the line of succession under the intestacy statutes. So in your will or your trust, I have families who do this. I will say money to my child, Mike, and if he should predecease me, then to his wife, Susie. So I specifically name everybody in that document, but also gives them standing with the court to be known.
But one other situation where a couple got married, and within a week of the time the husband died in a plane accident, hadn't changed his will yet. He had a will leaving it to his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And the sister said to the new wife, "Well, I'm sorry, all this is mine."
So this is why lawyers can make a lot of money really fast. So in cases where, we talk about the week, but sometimes it's longer than that, where someone forgets to update a beneficiary. I see that all the time, where they get married and they still have their IRA or something going to the kid from the prior marriage and skipping spouse, even though that wasn't the intent, or even if it was not done properly. So you as a spouse can have a marital property claim on these assets. So it's going to be extremely fact intensive. It's going to be very asset specific. The court, in the cases I've seen with this, we go asset by asset and determine how it could be held, marital property with rights of survivorship, just simply marital property, and then if the correct forms were done to make it where it needs to be. So eventually it turns into having to take assets and splitting them out. Because we can't invalidate a will, but we can make sure spouse receives their fair share under the marital property statutes.
Yeah. So doesn't the spouse have a basic right to at least part of that estate?
Yes, but it's going through asset by asset to determine what that is.
And this happened in Arizona, so and the wife got nothing. On that happy note, this has been very enlightening. I want to thank you both very much for being with us today, and hopefully we can do this again down the road. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here.
Emily Sellner is an associate attorney at Axley Law Firm, and Michael Riley, Mike's a of counsel attorney at the Axley Law Firm of Madison. Great to have them with us today, and we'll do this again down the road for sure. Coming up, we're going to be talking about an organization called the Dane County Food Collective and what it's doing, and maybe it give you some information about how you might get involved in something like this, no matter where you live in our state. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to turn our attention to an organization here in Wisconsin that's working to make the food industry better for workers, for customers, for the environment. It's called the Dane County Food Collective. And we have one of the members here with us in the studio, Evan Daniels. Evan Daniels is the owner of Cadre Restaurant and partner of Lola's High-Low Lounge of Madison. And Beyond the Kitchen, Evan is an advocate for community involvement and is an active member of the Main Street Alliance, as well as founding member of the Dane County Food Collective. And maybe you work in the food service industry in one way or another. Maybe you could talk about your experience as we move along today. What would you like to see changed or improved? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Evan, thanks a lot for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk about the Dane County Food Collective. How did it get started? Well, I think it's an interesting history.
It was definitely interesting. So the collective was started, you know, there was this little thing that happened a few years ago called COVID. And, all you know, in the restaurant industry in particular, you know, we would always make a joke that it was death, taxes, and restaurants because everybody's got to eat, right?
Yeah.
And then COVID happened, and all of a sudden, a lot of us chefs and restaurateurs found ourselves without
customers.
And it was frustrating. And so for that first year of COVID, everybody, for the most part, kind of just went inside themselves and did their own thing. Restaurants were doing different stuff all over the place. And as we were coming out of that first year, a group of us were socially distancing and having a whiskey in a friend's driveway, trying to talk about how we were all navigating things. And we realized that we had missed an opportunity to collectively navigate this horrible time as a whole. And so we said, well, what can we do to make sure that the next big thing that happens, or anything that we really want done, that we could be around to support each other, to try to make making change easier. And so a bunch of us got together at a table at Cadre, my restaurant, and we hammered out what was the beginning of the Dane County Food Collective.
It's pretty cool. And you have, and it's grown to be included. It's not just restaurant owners.
Yeah, I don't think the intent was ever, it was definitely started by restaurant people getting together. But I think, you know, a big concern that we had is a lot of organizations that are like that don't have a tendency to be super inclusive. And our food system is a full circle thing. You know, it's farmers and suppliers and food manufacturers, like we're all in the same boat. And so making something larger where everybody that's sort of food adjacent has a tool to come together and work on projects that they think are important was important to us to do.
What are the biggest issues facing the food, our food system today that you're working on?
Well, so the Dane County Food Collective itself doesn't have a ton of structure around those things. So I'll speak mostly to what I know is being worked on.
Sure.
Because essentially what we do is someone who will come to our meeting, there's no membership. You could show up. It's the first Tuesday of almost every month at the Madison Club at 7:30. And if you have a concern or something that you're trying to work on inside of the food system, we'll essentially bring it to the attention of everybody and hopefully make a connection, and then work starts getting done. It's very sort of decentralized. A couple of the things that we're working on right now, in particular, is the Dane County Food Action Plan, which is the first food plan that's been written in the state of Wisconsin, and it covers a whole host of food-related issues, from food access to making sure there's a better pipeline to get things from farmers to consumer to commercial rent structure. And so we're writing a sort of an overarching plan that we'll give to the city and the county, and hopefully they'll adopt some of our policies when we're done giving surveys and packaging it all up together. So that's one example. Something that I've personally been working on for a number of years now is trying to find affordable healthcare options for small businesses, because especially in light of the fact that the extended, extra subsidies for the healthcare marketplace are due to expire at the end of this year. A lot of restaurant workers, almost all of which are relatively young and rely on the marketplace, will find themselves having the added burden of more healthcare expense. And that what that does is that pushes people away from small business and towards larger corporations where the healthcare is subsidized because of this volume of the customer.
Yeah, and the organization, I mean, these are all local people, local organizations that are trying to, as in a collective fashion, do something that they couldn't each one do individually.
Absolutely. Well, and it's amazing. What I love about the meetings is when you get 20 or 30, 40 people together, meetings are usually split pretty evenly between attending virtually and in person. Turns out when you get that many people in a room and you have something that you want to work on, somebody else does too. And then somebody else has a resource that could be helpful. And the next thing you know, you're already starting to work on a thing and you haven't even left the meeting yet.
Yeah. And I, as I understand it, you like, you might just say, okay, well here, you and you, or they may raise their hand and say, I can work on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do have, you have the collective, but then you kind of break it down to be, you know, to give somebody the responsibilities to actually look deeper into it.
Well, it's all about pointing people at what they're passionate about. Noah Blodarn, who's our executive director, and is now the executive director of Reap Food Group as well, he has a postgraduate degree in community organizing. He seamlessly helps grab these disparate needs that people have and kind of lump them together and point people with like goals together, and it's pretty amazing to watch.
Yeah, that sounds great. The you mentioned health insurance, and that's what kind of benefits exist now for health insurance, and what's going? You said something's going away.
So since the Affordable Care Act passed, health insurance has been sort of interesting and not necessarily terrible. But the interesting thing about it is when the Affordable Care Act came into being, they extended the age of which young adults can be on their parents' insurance to 26, which is, that takes a chunk, a lot of service industry, especially in a college town like Wisconsin, they're going to be in that age range. And so they don't even necessarily want benefits because they're going to be piggybacking in on their parents' insurance. The marketplace, when you're young, absolutely, if you're young and your income isn't super high, absolutely beats the pants off of any traditional insurance plan that you would get directly from a broker or an institution. And so for a lot of small businesses, having to go out and get a health insurance plan with a specific provider and having to worry. I mean, I don't want to worry as a business owner. I don't want to worry about an insurance plan covering everything that everyone that works for me wants to do. I don't want to be in the health insurance business. And so the nice thing about the Affordable Care Act is for a lot of the younger people, which is the majority of our staff in the restaurant world, they can still go out and shop for their own at an expense that would be similar to what a copay would be at most jobs. If that gets defunded, which it is, what will end up happening is almost overnight, people's health care rates will go up roughly 33% January 1st.
Oh.
That's the, I'm sorry, of people who are shopping through the marketplace, which is, mind you, most of America. And so when that happens, all of a sudden, and it's going to, corporate rates will go up as well. It's going to go up all the way across the board. And people have budgeted for this. And then all of a sudden, finding a job where the job subsidizes a lot of your healthcare is going to become a lot more important. And that's big corporate jobs and less small business jobs. Because I have 8 full-time employees at Cadre. Like, that's not a lot of buying power when you compare it to Epic, which has, what, 8,000 employees?
Yeah.
And so we can't, it's taking more of the money from small businesses to provide insurance to their employees for a small business than it is for a large business. And the Affordable Care Act helped bridge that gap.
It's interesting, as I was thinking about it, and I don't remember the numbers, but small businesses really are, when you add it all up across the country, make up a huge portion of people's jobs and the amount of money that is generated from small businesses is very substantial, but it's each individual one, so they don't, the buying power or what have you, as you say, is not there. So it's kind of putting people in a real bind.
Mm-hmm. And so we've been actively working on trying to find alternatives to health insurance or different ways of being covered. Personally, at Cadre, we use direct primary care, which is amazing, where you're just paying for a singular doctor and people can go get supplemental insurance on the side. But this is just an example of the kind of work that the Dane County Food Collective does, because if it was just me looking, how would I be able to communicate with other people about what I've found and point other small business owners at the things that do and don't work for me? And this is the beauty of the organization.
Evan Dano, our guest today, Evan Danos, is the founding member of the Dane County Food Collective. And we're going to go into more detail and give you some more examples of the kind of work going on by the collective itself. And you might even think about it. I wonder if there are collectives in Milwaukee or Green Bay or other places, or if perhaps Evan and others have been contacted from those various parts of the state. You can join in with your own questions. Are you a food worker? Are you involved? Maybe you're a farmer. Maybe you're working a restaurant. Questions and what's on your mind relating to issues? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we take a look at the Dane County Food Collective and talk about some of the issues that are high of importance when it comes to those who work in the food industry, the whole food system. Evan Danels, our guest, he is the owner of Cadre Restaurant, partner of Lola's Hilo Lounge in Madison. It's great to have him with us, a founding member, of course, of the Dane County Food Collective. And again, questions or comments, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. How difficult is it to find qualified restaurant staff these days?
COVID has made it quite a bit more difficult. When COVID happened, I think a lot of industry professionals left the restaurant industry to go do other jobs, and very few of them came back. And so we find ourselves in a position right now of mostly trying. I would say the average age of a restaurant worker has gotten quite a bit younger, and so we're sort of trying to train in a new generation now, but that comes with a lot of its own obstacles as
well. Yeah, I was wondering how common burnout is. I mean, that's a high-paced job.
I mean, I think burnout, especially for a lot of the younger employees that had to experience a good chunk of their middle school or high school years or something like that, learning remotely, that it's a big change to be in sort of a fast paced restaurant world. So we're trying to be gentle. I mean, the nice thing that came out of COVID with restaurants was it definitely moved the goalposts for how most restaurant workers realized they needed to treat their employees, mm-hmm. and to adjust to the new reality of trying to make things maybe a little more steady and a little less crazy in restaurants.
You know, and it's, as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about for a lot of people, this is not a long-term career path for a lot of people these days.
It's definitely what a lot of people refer to as a transitional job. A lot of people work in restaurants because they're finishing grad school or they're waiting for their band to get a hit single or any number of other things like that. And I think that's been personally my largest focus with the Dane County Food Collective is trying to find things like health insurance that help make working in a restaurant a career as opposed to a job.
And you've got a website. Dane County Food Collective has a website, and I've noticed some interesting things on the website of things that you're doing. You're trying to be advocates in some ways as well. I mean, information on the website about op-ed writing or what other ones were on there, making videos. So, you know, where you're pushing forth your own thoughts.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, remember, the collective itself doesn't have views. Like, we're connecting like-minded people to work on whatever it is that they think is important. And so a big part of that is learning how to advocate for yourself. I mean, that's what this is. Everybody in the food system in some way or another has to get their kicks out of nurturing people and being of service. What better way to do that than work on it at the legislative level to get your voice out through op-eds? A lot of people don't realize they have this power. And the beauty of small business and the food system is that you are integral to the community. And so people want to listen to what you have to say. Nobody wants to have all their options be just national chains and giant commercial grocery stores. Like, small businesses are what bring flavor to community.
I looked, here's me, a professor in communication. So I took a look at the information on there, and I thought, this is really good. It's not advocating a particular, it's telling people, here's how you put together an opinion and get it out into the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the beauty of it, is we realize that we would get bogged down if we had views of our own, and so we're just trying to help empower people to start the conversation.
I'm wondering, have you have been contacted? I mean, there's been a little information out about the collective. Have other areas of the state, anybody else said, hey, how'd you put this together?
Not that I'm terribly aware of. NOAA's probably fielded a question or two. As far as I know, at least in this state, we're the only ones doing something like this, which is mostly thanks to having UW and the people who come out of it.
Yeah, another idea the collective is looking on as I was reading through it is resource sharing. And you got all these, you know, I don't know how many restaurants there are in the city of Madison, for example.
So many.
There are a lot. So, and I'm sure there's in the back of everybody's head, well, I want to be the one and I want to beat out everybody else. So there's this kind of competition. But at the same time, there could be ways that you could share resources.
Absolutely. Honest to God, I think COVID turned that on its head. There was very much a feeling pre-COVID of, I got to be better than that guy. My restaurant's got to be the first one to get this cheese every year and these kinds of things going on. And I think COVID pretty well destroyed that inside of Madison. We just all want everybody to be able to survive and thrive in the environment that we have. And I think that's pretty universally felt all the way around, which is why we were able to do this.
Yeah, I think... Well, that might have been the only good thing about COVID.
In our industry, I think that's probably about it.
I can remember spending, going to, ordering online or getting on the phone and talking to a favorite owner and ordering food and going and picking it up to kind of help support the restaurants that I...
Absolutely. And it affected the food system all over the place. You know, delivery grocery became a big thing. More people are eating takeout than dining in at a lot of restaurants, or at least proportionately more. All of those things affect our food system a ton. I mean, you're talking about a restaurant that might have $1 million plus in loan service. And during COVID, the model that they had designed that entire restaurant around gets flipped on its head. You can't really economically change the interior of your restaurant very easily. So you have to figure out other ways to adapt and save. And that's where the resource sharing comes in, is we've done things like establish a buying group with Kesnick so that people could get paper goods for less and things like that.
Oh, okay. So there's ways that you can kind of get together and still be able to maintain your independence of, okay, this is my business, but we all need whatever it is.
Everybody needs to-go containers.
Oh, to-go container, yeah. And do they always have to be with the name of your own restaurant?
Not necessarily, no.
I wouldn't see why they would have to. What about working with local farmers?
Well, I mean, that's something that's very, very front and center in terms of my passion. I moved here because of the farming infrastructure in southern Wisconsin and access to the farmers market in particular. Mind you, that was 24 years ago. Even during COVID, some of those things changed. A guy that is an old friend of mine named Scott Williams had a farm called Garden to Be. And during COVID, a lot of people didn't have the energy to go out and direct market their own farms. And so he started doing it for Farley Center Farms and a handful of other ones. And now he's turned it into a whole business. He supplies probably half of the locally focused restaurants in town, if not more, and has made a huge impact on our community here. And so, but that's more of that same kind of stuff. You know, you can do it, but there's always, somebody's always going to find something more that you can do to make it even better. And that's the goal of the Food Collective.
Well, REAP, the organization, serves as the collective's fiscal sponsor, which is a great organization in and of itself.
Absolutely. It was a perfect match.
And I, before we run out of time, I want to make sure that we talk about an event. You want to eat some local food and listen to music. There's an event coming up.
Yes, there is. We are doing a music and food festival. It's mostly Lola's and the guys from the Mallard Stadium. It's called True North. It is next Saturday. Gates open at 3 p.m. We've got six different musical acts going on a stage in the center. We've got 12 local restaurants that'll be vending there. We got a Ferris wheel. And it's going to be a whole lot of fun. We're hoping that this is it looks like it's probably going to be as successful as we hope. And so we're hoping this is the first year of something that we will continue to do. We just wanted something that could bring the North Side kind of together, because that's where Lola's is, and bring a lot of restaurants from the North and East Side together to just celebrate music and food and everything that comes between.
Yeah, and it's I saw the entry, the cost to get in, the ticketing is pretty cheap, reasonable.
Absolutely. We're trying to keep it as affordable as possible. So the Dane County Food Collective and Dais are both going to be recipients of some of the gate from this. So we're both really excited about that. And I think we're going to have a table too. So if people have more questions about either organization, they're welcome to come find us at the festival.
And that's again, and it's at Warner Park.
Yep.
At the Duck Pond. And there's even, I think, some sort of executive, sort of higher-end tickets, too, that you can...
I believe the VIP tickets are sold out.
Oh, they are, okay.
At this point. But, I mean, even general admission, it's going to be...
What is it, $15 or $18, something like
that? That sounds right.
$18 at the gate.
I think so, yeah.
I think it's $15 or $18 at the gate. And you're going to have a chance to sample some food. And some drink and listen to a whole lot of. I looked at the bands. I like them.
Yeah, it's very Matt Girding, who was the mastermind before for this whole thing, who is one of the partners in Lola's. He absolutely loves jazz and Louisiana and summertime, and so this positively would not have been conceived of without him.
Evan Daniels, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. It's fun to learn about what's going on with the Dane County Food Collective. I think it's a pretty neat organization, and probably some other areas of the state might be wanting to contact you about how you do what you do. And thank you, as you've been listening in, for joining us today. Our shows are a team effort. We've got Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.